Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to this special edition of Breaking Banks and Crypto Capsule, coming to you from, well, all around the world. We have New York, we have London and Hong Kong. And CZ, where are you? I don't know. What's your location?
I'm in Singapore.
You're in Singapore. Okay. Yep. I should know that. But we have this incredible special edition of this joint podcast for you guys, and you're going to love it. Joining me back on the show as regulars today is Ajit Tripathi. And of course, co-hosting along with us from Crypto Capsule is Henry Aslanian. Henry, welcome back on the show.
Always a pleasure being on, Brett.
And we're very pleased to have with us from Binance, CZ, for all the way from Singapore.
Thank you for having me.
Are you in lockdown there, or what's going on in Singapore?
Yeah, it's a pretty strict lockdown. So only supposed to go out for groceries or essential needs. So like doctors or stuff.
Same as New York, yeah.
So great. Pretty tight lockdown.
Yeah, well, when we envisaged doing this show and putting this together, there was a lot of back and forth, but obviously the biggest question we want to sort of start with here and sort of get the state of play is, you know, what's going to happen with crypto when we come out of COVID-19? That's really a question. Is COVID-19 going to help or hinder crypto? Is the potential of digital currencies as a result of the problems we have with cash because it could be a transmission vector? There's some really good questions here. But first of all, Henry, how are things going where you are? You're not in Hong Kong. Actually, you're in Armenia still, are you?
Yeah, exactly. I'm here in Armenia now. It's been a couple of weeks. I'm heading back to Hong Kong in 2 weeks. And I have to say, I'm very excited to be back in Hong Kong. I'm not looking forward to my 2 week mandatory quarantine with that monitoring bracelet on my arm. But it is what it is, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm trying to get to Thailand and, you know, they're still in lockdown. I can't even get in yet. So, yeah, similarly. And Ajit, how's the Peloton going?
Oh, it's absolutely wonderful. Keeps me very, very busy during the lockdown. I mean, CZ keeps me very busy and the Peloton keeps me fit.
Yeah, good. All right. So before we get to, you know, diving straight into the crypto stuff, how about CZ? Why don't we get a bit of background on what led you to the moment of creation of Binance and how that journey has been for you in Singapore, which is a fairly fintech friendly, you know, jurisdiction.
So do you want, I'll give you the sort of story, longer version then. So I went to school, I was born in China, and then I went to Canada when I was about 12. So when there was a sort of a beginning of the teenager years, went to high school and then university. I went to intern in Tokyo working for, outsourced consulting firm, writing some software related to the Tokyo Stock Exchange. So that's my first exposure into the sort of fintech industry. That's like almost exactly 20 years ago, well, actually a bit more than 20 years ago now. So, and then I graduated from university, worked in Tokyo for a few years, and then 2000 dot-com bubble hit. The job market in Tokyo is pretty bad. And then I went to look for a job in New York. Bloomberg was the only one hiring. So I landed a job in Bloomberg, building like futures trading systems there. And then in 2005, I quit Bloomberg to go back to Shanghai together with five other guys to start a IT company. I was the only sort of Asian looking person in that group. And so five Caucasians and then myself in Shanghai. And then I ran that company for 8 years. I was the youngest guy in out of all the partners. And so I was the youngest partner. And 8 years later, in 2013, I learned about Bitcoin. I thought, well, that's pretty interesting. I asked the partners if they want to build a Bitcoin exchange or a Bitcoin payment company. BitPay was already there. And then Mongox was pretty big. And they were kind of hesitant to build another product. So I said, well, then if that's the case, I'm going to quit and then look for a new job in crypto. Quit my job at the same time also sold my house to get enough cash to buy Bitcoin. So I sold my little apartment in Shanghai for just under $1 million, put all of that into Bitcoin. I think I got about 1,500 Bitcoins out of that transaction. I still have those, didn't change. And then in crypto, I was looking for a job, bumping into Roger Ver. And
he's
a big investor. He's a big investor in blockchain.info. And so I was the third employee into blockchain.info right after Ben Reeves, the founder, and then Nicholas Carey was there. So I was the third guy in. But then after a little while, there was this new, there's another opportunity in China, a cryptocurrency exchange. So I joined OKCoin for a while. But then I found the values and ethos didn't really match my own. So I left that in early 2015. And then I started my own software company doing cloud exchange systems for other exchanges. And some of the clients, so that's a B2B model. Some of our clients were not crypto related, to be honest. There's only a couple crypto clients. So did that in 2015. And actually, when I was starting that company, I originally wanted to do a cryptocurrency exchange in Japan, but then I don't speak Japanese that well. And two of my co-founders, they didn't speak Japanese either. So we've kind of, a week later, we figured out, okay, we couldn't do that. But we got lucky that that business actually took off. We were actually just selling cloud exchange system to other exchanges. 2017, there were some regulatory changes that killed, that basically shut down most of our clients. So it killed our business. And then that was like March 2017. And then we're looking around, it's like, well, what should we do now? Maybe we should do a crypto exchange again. So at that time, Poloniex was really big. Bittrex is coming up very aggressively as well. So those two are the two biggest crypto exchanges in the world, and they were making good money. And we looked at it, we said, well, the interface is pretty simplistic. They're only available on the web, not available on mobile. They're only available in English. And the customer support typically takes a month or two to reply to a customer who has their funds stuck. So we can probably do better than that. So that's how we started it to Binance in 2017. So that's kind of the long story.
Oh, it's a good story. You know, I've got a similar sort of like history to you, except I didn't end up in the exchange or crypto world significantly. But I remember a networking event in New York in December of 2010, where I met up with Roger Ver and Charlie Shrem. They were very early days in the Bitcoin experience here in New York. But that's fascinating. Yeah. So, Henry, maybe give us a state of play of what's going on in the crypto space right now, because you live this stuff every day.
Everybody has their crypto moment, you know, when we discovered it and how we fell through a rabbit hole, right? And I'll ask a question for CZ, but no, before obviously I answer your question, Brett, you know, it's very interesting because every year in the crypto ecosystem, May is always the big month of announcements and developments, because obviously normally we have consensus, we have blockchain week, actually in New York, where I always try to meet up with you, Brett, and there's this year, obviously because of coronavirus, it was all gone virtual. So literally last month, we had a flurry of developments that came in. I mean, not only more at a macro level on the market side, the price of Bitcoin has doubled almost since February, but also we had the halving, you know, the historic halving that happens every 4 years, happened literally on May 12th or so. So there was obviously a lot of media attention, a lot of news about it. But also on the investor side, there were some developments as well. Obviously, and I'm sure we'll talk about it today with Paul Tudor Jones and the announcement that he's looking at crypto, to even, you know, on the CME, you know, BTC futures were hitting a new record, to even on the other, on the equity investment side with Andreessen Horowitz announcing a new $550 million fund on crypto. And even on the more liquid side, I mean, at PwC, we just released our second annual crypto hedge fund report that showed that the AUM in crypto hedge funds has doubled in 2019 compared to 2018. So a lot of developments on the market side. On the industry side, there were some bad news. I mean, probably the one that really caught my attention and is obviously Telegram, where Pavel, their CEO, mentioned that they will not be involved anymore in the blockchain project they were spearheading. To even the Libra Association in Singapore, where we're just talking, where Temasek has joined as one of the members of the Libra Association. They just got a new CEO. And I would say on the last, maybe not least, on the policy side, you know, if I put my professor or my lawyer hat on, really it's been very interesting what we're seeing on the CBD side, the central bank digital currency side, and as well as the broader policy side. For example, the European Central Bank announced that they are exploring the optimal design of a CBDC, and they're worried about the survival of banks if people are able to convert the bank deposits into CBDC on a one-to-one ratio. And as well, it's maybe closer to where I live in China, where the PBOC has announced and confirmed that they're going to launch their pilots for their DCEP, the Digital Currency Electronic Payment. And around the world, there's been a very regulatory developments, like in the Cayman Islands, for example, they just issued a lot of regulatory new regulatory framework for crypto. So a lot of things that happened. And actually, Brett, as you mentioned before, my 60-second weekly show on LinkedIn, the Crypto Capsule, for once, the first time I think in many years, I had to do over 60 seconds and do a 3-minute version just because there were so many developments going on. But maybe just passing it back to Changpeng on this, on, you know, obviously, CZ, we've been in the crypto ecosystem for many years. And obviously, over the years, we've seen this surge of interest in crypto, right? I mean, last one was 2017, when the price of Bitcoin shot up. Right now, with the COVID-19 that Brett was mentioning, the fact that actually we're going through the biggest quantitative easing in our history, do you think this surge of interest we're seeing in crypto is different from the previous ones? And, you know, like we're seeing a lot of rating on many crypto exchanges, a lot of interest. Do you think it's different this time from the previous waves of interest you've seen over the last couple of years?
Oh, yeah. I think it's definitely different. I think basically there were a few, well, the ones that I realized, like, for example, there's a few critical points where everyone thought the price would jump right away. But the price doesn't jump right away, but the price jumped later, and the interest level is different. So in January 2015, just as I was starting the previous company before Binance, that turned into Binance, the chairman of Central Bank China said banks should research blockchain. And that's super positive. Overnight, all the companies changed from Bitcoin companies into blockchain companies. And the price didn't jump that much, actually. The price didn't go up that much. The price was starting to go up slowly. But then that's the end of the sort of $200 Bitcoin era. So back then, a Bitcoin is worth $200 in 2015. Mm-hmm. And then 2017, I think just around March 2017, the ICOs are going, they're going pretty hot. Price started going up, but again, they went from 3,000 to about 20,000 towards end of 2017. And we have data from that period. Back in that period, the number of new user registrations are quite high, very high. And we are, I think for new user registrations, even right now, is not at that phenomenal, like frenzied level just yet. Back then, when we turn on registration for an hour, we get 300,000 registered users in 1 hour. So it's like our system just couldn't keep up. So we had to shut down registrations. I think right now we're not quite there yet, but what's very different when we saw March 12th, when the Bitcoin price dived on like to about $4,000, $3,000, when it stayed at $5,000 or $6,000, at that level, the trading activity was much higher than 6 months ago at $6,000 when Bitcoin was at $6,000. So even though at the same price, the amount of trading is much, much higher, which basically means that there's a lot more users coming into crypto. And sure enough, the price went up later on. So I think we're still early days. We just passed the halving. The effect of that hasn't fully kicked in yet, I think. And then with all the quantitative easing, all the COVID-19, I think the effects will kick in over the next little while. I observed that happening a few times before, and pretty sure it will happen again.
CZ, there is a question for me here. So, you know, Binance is now pretty global, and you're doing a lot of work around the world. So in the last 5 or 6 years, I've seen a lot of discussion about how blockchain technology will change a number of industries. But after all this time, we are still seeing that cryptocurrency is still the dominant application. And there is, you know, I mean, from my vantage point, there isn't too much else going on in terms of applications and that consumers can use. Are you seeing any different? I mean, where do you see most of this potential in like day-to-day lives of consumers beyond crypto?
To be very frank there, I think we haven't really found many real wide adopted applications for cryptocurrency just yet. I think all the concepts work and all the concepts make sense. So cryptocurrency will replace anything that requires a central party or could have the potential to do that. Decentralized trust, notaries, I don't know, anything you need. But fundamentally, I think right now there's really two applications that cryptocurrencies are very strong in. There's more coming now. I think exchanges, like just trading, speculation on the cryptocurrency price is obviously one that's relatively high volume, high profit for businesses that are successful in this space. So we see successful exchanges being the ones that's making a decent business. And then fundraising, ICOs was overly hot, but I think fundraising on the blockchain will still continue to work. There's not a lot of activity now, but I think we'll probably overswing on the downside. There's a few obvious ones which did not take off fully yet. Crypto payments is a very obvious one, but given that the traditional payment rails are relatively established, it will take some time to sort of disrupt them. So I think that will take a little bit more time, but there are more and more innovative solutions now. So now you can get a crypto paid credit card, and that works with traditional payment rails, but you can fund that in crypto. this allows you to exist in both worlds. There's like gaming, retail, DeFi, even CeFi, crypto financing was pretty big last year and is continuing to evolving right now. So there's a lot of those areas that could come. But I do agree with your sentiment, which is there's not been a lot of explosive real applications just yet. But if you look at the even if you look at the internet, e-commerce took off like in 2000, after 2000, right? So before there was like eBay, there was like, but it wasn't that big. Amazon wasn't that big. So it took like 10, 15 years for that to kick off as well. So I think basically it's going to take years, but it's going to happen.
So putting aside the fact that when we talk about what Henry introduced, the central bank digital currencies, and putting aside the fact that China is not actually putting theirs on a blockchain, but it is a digital currency. So you could definitely say it's inspired by cryptocurrencies. And of course, we've seen recently in the United States that JP Morgan have announced their banking Coinbase and the Winklevoy, or Gemini, as we know their official operation. The fact is, we appear to be getting much closer to, we're definitely getting away from this regulatory concerns that we had in the early days, and we're seeing the operationalizing of cryptocurrency on a whole different level. And so, ultimately, when you've got China banking, digital currency, and you've got, side by side, technology-based cryptocurrencies, if you like, or, rather than fiat-based. What's the difference between custody of cryptocurrencies versus custody of digital currencies created by, central banks? So, coming to the question, is there a chance that Binance is indistinguishable from a bank in 3 or 5 years, or would you go down the path of getting a banking license yourselves?
Okay. I think there's a number of interesting points there. I think on the central bank digital currency front, I think China's the DCEP coin is now in pilot. I think it probably uses some type of technology similar to blockchain, but I don't think it's really decentralized. There's obviously a single issuer that has full control over it. So even though it uses some stuff that's blockchain related, they probably use a consensus mechanism in there,
right,
with a number of banks running the nodes, etc. It probably does not offer the same level of decentralization or freedom as Bitcoin does. So those things matter. Whether that's good for our industry or not, I think it's definitely more positive. For Binance, I think our approach is to provide infrastructure in the crypto space. So I guess today we have never been looking forward to becoming a bank, so we will not become a bank. There has been many banks that has proposed to us to ask us if we want to buy them or invest in them, stuff like that. We invest in a bank in Malta already, a new bank. I wouldn't rule out even acquiring or buying a bank just so that we have a fiat on ramp in a few places. But doing that, it doesn't mean we want to become a bank. It's just right. That we view that as something good to have and useful.
Yeah, regulatory arbitrage. Yeah.
more like regulatory compliance.
Yeah, exactly.
But on this point, CZ, I mean, obviously the industry has changed a lot for crypto exchanges over the last couple of years. Obviously, we have the big, let's say the US players it's very regulatory focused. And obviously then we have a lot of the, crypto exchanges over the years where, I think even you mentioned at one point, CZ, where I think it was one of the recent interviews you did that you're not incorporated anywhere. You're not kind of exist in the crypto space. What do you think we'll see a bifurcation at one point of really exchanges that will just try to focus on the regulated space, like Brett mentioned before, Gemini and the Coinbase and others in the US and others will be more focusing on becoming servicing the crypto space, because especially there's a new lot of requirements coming in from FATF travel rules and other global compliance requirements.
I think there's a gradient scale there. I think this is one of the things where many people view it as a black and white situation. You're either regulated or you're not. Whereas in real life, there's probably a gradient scale that you can achieve somewhere in there. I think if you're in a financially developed, established country, especially like the United States, basically you got to be fully regulated. There's really no choice there. In other countries, though, the regulations are less clear. What is a security or not a security is even less clear. How do they enforce it is also less clear. Some countries are very openly pro-crypto. They want to adopt cryptocurrencies as current. They recognize Bitcoin as currencies, such as Japan. So I think each country has very different regulations right now, and that's going to be some experiments and settling down. People are still trying to figure out what's the best way to regulate so that we encourage innovation, but also protect users. And then as a company, you can also operate in a number of different ways. A lot of people who grew up in big countries, like especially like in China or in the US, they view that country as the entire world. So all they're thinking is like, it's just one country, right?
Yeah.
And so I see that a lot. But for people who have traveled around different countries, we view the world as one, and there are many countries in the world. You can say, look, I want to do my business in two-thirds of the countries, and then I want to attack the other one-third later. So there's many different strategies there. And also the type of business you can do determines what level of compliance you need. For example, if you touch fiat, then obviously you want to go full board AML, KYC compliance, etc. I think right now more and more countries are regulating cryptocurrencies as currencies. So now you have to be more compliant like traditionally. The difference is disappearing. But like a few years ago, that's a gray area, and you have more room to operate. So, and luckily for Binance, we kind of grew up in a lot of the gray area era, and now we're big enough that we can afford the lawyers to sort of get compliant, etc. So I think our strategy is we also want to enable a lot of fiat access. We started as a crypto-to-crypto exchange, so now we want to enable fiat access. For our fiat gateways, we have to be fully compliant, fully regulated. They have to have a domicile location. They have to have a bank account. So in that type of situations, yeah, you do have to be fully, very well compliant. So I think I view there's multiple sort of levels of regulatory compliance overhead in different regions of the world. So I view it as a sort of a grayscale situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think on one thing we're seeing with regulations around the world is actually one thing 2 years ago the community was asking was more regulatory clarity. Actually, today, according to Cambridge University, only 5% of regulators don't have somebody working on crypto. So thankfully, there's been more clarity, which is great from that perspective. I think we'll talk about all these things, CZ. Maybe I think we need to take a little break. So again, for everybody, we're here with Changpeng Zhao, the CEO of Binance, with Brett King and Ajit Tripathi from Breaking Banks, and myself, Henry Arslian from Crypto Capsule, for this special edition of Crypto Special Edition of Breaking Banks and Crypto Capsule. We'll be back after this break, after a couple of words from the people who make this show possible.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to the special Crypto Capsule edition of Breaking Banks with our very, very special guest, CZ from Binance. CZ, I have a question for you. You know, we've been waiting for this, and you are on Twitter, and I'm on Twitter quite a lot, not that I should tell you. But, you know, we talk about this institutional wall of money in crypto quite a bit, right? So institutional investors are coming, they're coming. JP Morgan, Goldman, a number of banks have made a lot of small experimental efforts. But is that institutional wall of money really here? I mean, are institutions actively investing in crypto assets? Is this asset class really emerging?
I think the institutional participation is similar to the retail participation at a very low percentage. I think below even one digit percentage. So I think if you look at the world, probably only 0.1% of the population have crypto. So one in 1,000 people have crypto so far. I think that's also a similar situation with the institutions. So on the bad side, like adoptions, we're still very early in the adoption process. On the good side, there's a lot of room to grow. So, but we've seen that institution participation is getting much stronger now. I think the first quarter of 2020, we've seen almost a 113% increase over the last quarter of 2019 for institutional activities on our platform. We also see that institutions in crypto are different from the institutions in the traditional sort of financial space. Many large organizations in the traditional financial space, when they want to get into crypto, they form a new company. And they do so usually a spin-off or a much smaller sized company to do institutional trading in crypto. The amount of funds they put in are still a very small percentage of their overall fund. And also forming a new company gets them give them a lot more flexibility in terms of how to trade. So we're seeing definitely more increased institutional involvement in the space, but they may not be the exact same institution. They may not be exactly the same company, but company is pretty fungible, right? So you can register a new company pretty easily. So we're seeing that happening. And today, we do see a lot of institutional trading on Binance platforms or across our product ecosystems.
That's a great point, CZ. In fact, there's a pretty different culture. If you take something like Japan, you know, where you talked about earlier, and even in Singapore, compared with the United States, there's a very different culture of building businesses. We know Gemini has been trying to, you know, get a ETF going for years based on Bitcoin in the US. So, Henry, you know, how do you characterize this difference between the Asia and the US culture in respect to crypto?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question, Brett. You know, as you know, I'm originally from Montreal, Canada, but I spent the last 15 years or so in China and Hong Kong and Asia more generally. And I have to say, in the crypto space, I find this the difference of the ecosystem very, very interesting. You know, especially if I put my PwC Global Crypto Leader hat on, you know, where we see a lot of the companies evolve. One thing I've seen, and I'd love to get your views on this, Chuck Pang, afterwards, is basically a lot of the U.S. companies that were launching, you know, like the Coinbase, Gemini, and stuff, and many of their peers you mentioned, really trying to get the regulations in place first, make sure everything was compliant, all the dots were checked before they get to market. Whereas in Asia, what we've seen is really a kind of a culture of experimenting, trying, innovating fast, pivoting quickly. And I would argue that today, if I look globally, Asia is definitely the region you need to be when it comes to where the crypto industry is heading. I mean, Brent, I think we're seeing this on the fintech space more broadly.
I absolutely agree. I absolutely agree.
Definitely on the crypto side, it's blockchain.
We don't even have fintech charters in the US yet for banking, right?
As one of the many, right?
Yeah, so CZ, you've been a bit ahead of the game on this, right? As in you made a significant investment in India recently, and that was when it wasn't completely clear if India is going to allow crypto. What's your thought process, and which markets are you seeing from a crypto fintech perspective that are most attractive to you?
I think we just invest in good teams. Once we identify a really strong team, we just invest. And we actually want, the way we think about it is really, when there's uncertainty, there's a high risk, but there's also high reward. And so we can get good deals during those times. Whereas like when there's certainty, I think Coinbase recently just investing in CoinDCX in India today probably. Mm-hmm. I don't know the terms of that deal, but it's probably now we got a bit of a head start compared to them. And on the point of Asia innovation startups versus US, there's a very stark difference. I think in the US, if you start a crypto company, you're starting a financial company. You're not starting a tech startup. You have to get all the regulatory licenses, and there's 48 states you have to get licenses for. And each of them costs about $500,000. So you got to have $25 million just to get the licenses, and you got to hire a bunch of lawyers, takes years. And that's not a startup, right? That's a financial. If you don't have a really thick book, you can't really afford that. Whereas in Asia, you are able to launch a crypto company. And when you're small, you can get away with not having full licenses. There's a lot of places where it's not clear what a license even means. So you can do those kind of stuff. Less regulated countries, and that will allow you to sort of iterate, build, scale, fail, retry, do all of those things. Whereas in the heavily regulated countries, you can't do that. So yeah, that's a huge difference.
CZ, just before I know Henry's got a question on the exchange side, but from a regulatory perspective, I'd be interested to know, have any regulators actually reached out to Binance and sought to attract you guys into their market? Or has it been sort of more one way from you guys engaging them?
It's gone both ways. I've had many head of states reaching out to me saying, like, we would like to invite you to our to our home. But there's usually some strings attached as well, because countries are not individuals, right? So even if the president of a country invites us, we have to go through their monetary authority or some other institution. That's not always a come over, do whatever you want. There's still always compliance, regulatory issues, rules we have to comply with. Some of them are positive, some of them are not. So yes, we have been invited a few times, mostly by smaller island countries, actually.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was in St. Petersburg for the Economic Investment Forum a few years ago, and I was on a panel with Vitalik on blockchain and crypto. And immediately after the panel, these guys come in, you know, like looking like security guys, and drag him off to speak to Putin about blockchain. Wow. And then within weeks of that meeting, there's all these announcements about Russia deploying blockchain everywhere. So Vitalik did his job, apparently. But Henry, over to you, man.
Yeah, it's the importance of meetings in person. Huh? Yeah. This always shows it once again. But actually, Changbin, I have a quick question for you on the exchanges, right? Obviously, the global crypto exchange landscape is changing quite a bit. Curious to get from your side, what are the big trends you expect to see that we'll see with crypto exchanges over the next couple of months? But also a related point to that, you know, one thing that you guys were probably one of the earlier ones was also on the exchange tokens, right? Like the BNB that the Binance had. And obviously we can go to a whole debate around that, whether it's a security or not, and you know, all the debate around that. And many of them afterwards have done it. Bitstamp with Leo, FTX with their own coin, KuCoin, and many others have done. When you look at the future of exchanges, do you believe there'll be how the landscape will change? How do you think many of them will scale? And do you think more of them will launch exchange tokens like BNB over the coming months?
Yeah, I think the landscape's always changing. The things change so fast in this industry. If you blink, then things change. So I think things will continue to evolve. On the topic of exchange tokens, I think almost every company will issue a token later. Almost any successful company should issue a token. In places where there are strong security regulations, I would highly suggest them to structure it so that it doesn't tie to profit, it doesn't tie to shares, it doesn't tie to voting rights. Just make it a utility token so that people use it in your ecosystem. And if you can build an ecosystem or a platform that enough people want to use your platform and they can use that token to pay for fees, that's usually a very simple, viable business model or a token model. And you can sort of tweak that in many different ways. So I think we were one of the first centralized businesses to issue a token. And then many others actually followed. Luckily, our token kind of works. So the BNB token has grown quite healthily and is very stable, relatively stable. It doesn't go crazy up and downs. It's maintained price for over 2.5 years. So right now it's about 170x of the ICO price. So we're very much clear from that. And there's real utility in the BNB token. I think a lot more exchanges will copy that. And today, every day there's more exchanges than there are more new exchanges than there are more new tokens. So that has always been the case. In the exchange landscape, I think exchanges, there's really a few different types of exchanges now. There's the sort of crypto to crypto global exchanges that are competing globally. And the competition there is very fierce. So you've got to offer additional value added services like staking, loans, savings, all of those fancy features. And there's also more competition on the derivative space, futures, options, other derivatives, etc. On the other side, we have the fiat exchanges that have to deal with regulations, touch fiat, have bank accounts, etc. They're regulated in each region differently. So I think all of those things play a role in the exchange space now. And it's going to get much harder to compete as we keep going forward.
Yeah, CZ, one of the things that has, you know, amazed everyone is the speed at which Binance has scaled. And you've spoken about blitz scaling in the past. I live in the fintech capital of the world, arguably. Although Brett doesn't agree, Brett thinks it's Shenzhen and not London. What's your advice to fintechs in Europe or elsewhere in terms of scaling? How can fintechs scale successfully in the way you've done?
I guess my advice doesn't really apply to fintechs only, but just any company. I think just got to try new ideas. I think Google pioneered this like 20% innovation thing.
We do
that more like 50%. So we have our core business of exchange, yeah, which luckily is very highly profitable and is able to fund a lot of the other initiatives that we try and are able to afford to have failures. And we run a decentralized organization. People are spread. I think the decentralization, the fiscal decentralization aspect of it, actually helps because people talk less and they come up with their own ideas and try different things. And the communication barrier is actually good for innovation that way. I have the personality, I like to encourage people to try new stuff as long as we can control the downside. So as long as something fails, it's a small fail. And if I like to encourage projects where if it succeeds, it's a big success. So in that case, we can have 10 failures and one success, and that works. So we do a lot of that.
As a founder of a fintech, I definitely get that. In fact, even from a cultural perspective, I think a lot of guys that come and work for fintechs or startups in the space, they're looking for that jazz. They're looking for that energy. They don't want to be in a very traditional thinking environment. They want to be challenged constantly. And so if I look at our most productive times as a challenger bank and then as a banking as a service player in the space, our best times are when the team is all focused on that process of innovation, because it's that creativity and that feeling like you're pushing the boundaries, which really gets the team energized. I definitely agree with that. There's also, as a founder, also there's a lot of times where, you know, the business has come very close to either clashing with the regulatory world or you know, with financing issues and stuff like that, you know, and so fintechs are tough to do, you know, particularly in the crypto environment. There's been a lot of regulatory uncertainty and so forth, as we've discussed. But what keeps you up at night, CZ? You know, is it continued growth? Is it risk? Is it regulation? You know, what for you as a founder, where are you spend your cycles on thinking about the future of finance?
The thing that keeps me at night is really, I think Bitcoin is highly volatile, and I think any day you can go 10x. And when that happens, we just get a huge influx of users. So I'm very happy for that to happen. But whenever that happens, our system gets a lot of load. And so that's the thing that really keeps me up at night. It's like, when that happens, are our systems able to handle it?
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to stress test this in the test environment. We do that all the time, but it's just different from the real environment. So I said this just literally like a week before March 12th, and March 12th happened a week later, and a couple other exchanges couldn't cope with it. And we've seen a lot of growth after that. And I think right now it could happen any day again. So that's kind of the thing in short term we're trying to get used to. Longer term, I think we just want to be able to provide services people want to use, and we want to provide access to crypto. So we want to help people to access crypto. So whatever fiat channels, whatever other ways for people to get their hands on crypto, we want to be able to provide that channel. So that's kind of what we're focused on in the long term.
That's awesome.
Absolutely.
The end of the show, you know, there's a tradition, I think for the listeners who see me on stage, I always bring my bell with me. So we're gonna do this like fire round questions, CZ. So I'm going to ask these quick questions. I need one or two word answers. So we're going to go quickly, 10 seconds each, and you'll give me quick answer. Sounds good? And wow, I have okay, my bell here, put it in. So let's kick it off. So CZ, if you were going to back to university today, what is the one course you recommend university students take today?
Blockchain courses.
Second, what do you do when you're not working on Binance activities? What do you do on your spare time?
Sleeping, usually. Listening to books.
Good. Well, come back to my third question. What is your favorite quiz? There's one book you recommend our listeners to read. What would that be?
I would say The Law by Frederick Bastiat from 1850.
Wow, very interesting. I think nice don't choice. Be serious. Amazon. What is the one person you admire the most today in the crypto industry? One person you listen to the most or you admire the most?
I think I admire Vitalik the most because he says he wants centralized exchanges to burn in hell.
Yeah. Other question. If you're not today an entrepreneur, what would you be doing?
I'd be thinking about how to become one.
And the last question, CZ, if you could have lunch with one person, dead or alive, one person, who would you want to have lunch with?
I think publicly, I would say Elon Musk. Privately, I would probably say Satoshi Nakamoto. But there's a flip side of me, which I don't want to meet Satoshi Nakamoto. I don't want to know who he is. But Elon Musk, I respect a lot. That guy's just crazy.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, I think this is always a good one to see. Maybe Brett, I'll pass it back to you to wrap it up.
Have you heard of the four Satoshi theory, CZ?
You mean multiple guys? There's a team?
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard about that, yes.
Okay. Yeah, well, I heard that from, I won't say who I heard it from, because anyway, all right, so let's not get into Satoshi investigations right now. That'll take us off on a whole different tangent, but we are coming to the close. That was a great session, CZ. I think you're a little modest. You know you're the founder of the largest cryptocurrency exchange in the world right now, so when you talk about your capabilities and so forth here, you know, as a team, we just want to say you've done a phenomenal job, and we're very grateful that you gave us some time today, and stay safe during coronavirus. But can I ask you, just to close out the show, how do people find out more about what's happening with Binance right now?
I think the easiest way is just to follow Binance on Twitter. That's probably the easiest way. Yeah, follow our blog, follow our announcements, download our app, and just use Binance. And you don't have to have an account to use the Binance app. You can track cryptocurrency prices, etc. And we're going to add a news section in there so you can track crypto news. So awesome. I think that's the best way. Yeah.
Fantastic.
And it's been a really fun podcast. And thank you for having me.
No, it's great. Well, thank you to Henry and Arjit for helping us set this up as well. So, Henry, how do we keep in touch with Crypto Capsule?
Exactly where the bell is always resides. But for listeners who want to follow the work, it's the best way is LinkedIn. So on Henry Arslanian, Henry with an I in the French-Canadian way, Arslanian in A-R-S-L-A-N-I-N, in a typical Armenian name, but where we have the Crypto Capsule every week, the 60-second review, and as well my Future of Money newsletter every Saturday where we talk the big trends. So on Twitter as well, again, at Henry Arslanian. Great to have this show together. It was really fun.
Fantastic. Yeah, absolutely. And Arjit?
Well, I'll be on Twitter, and I'll be on Breaking Banks Europe next week again. Thank you.
Absolutely. So check it out. You've been listening to Breaking Banks, a special edition crypto capsule, Breaking Banks US and Breaking Banks Global and Breaking Banks Europe combined. So a tour de force of cryptocurrency. CZ Changpeng Zhao from Binance has been our very special guest today, and we're very grateful to have him on. That's it for the show. We will see you again next week. Keep cryptoing. And if you love this, make sure you give us a like, retweet Henry's stuff on LinkedIn, or reshare his stuff on LinkedIn. Give us a 5-star review for the podcast. Stay happy. And thank you for listening.
Buy Bitcoin.
And buy Bitcoin. And that's it. Bitcoin. See you later, guys.
Cheers.
Cheers. Thank you.
That's it for this week. Thanks to our guests and to our sponsors who help make the show possible. You may have a little more time on your hands right now, so you can listen to all of our more than 300 shows, plus episodes from all of our other shows, including Breaking Banks Europe, Tech on Reg, the Finovate podcast, and more, all on Provoke.fm. I hope you like them, and if so, that you'll give all the shows 5 stars and share them with others. Stay home if you can, take care of your loved ones, and let's all work together to move this industry forward and to make it stronger than ever. That's it for this week. We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.